supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Monsignor William Lynn, America's first Catholic Church official to be convicted of covering up clergy sex abuse, is now on track for a new trial. WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports that a Philadelphia judge made that ruling during a brief hearing this afternoon.
Common Pleas Court Judge Gwendolyn Bright denied Lynn's motion to dismiss, so he'll get a retrial. His lawyers have argued the 66-year-old shouldn't face one because prosecutors intentionally concealed favorable evidence during his first trial in 2012. Evidence, they say, that would have discredited the victim at the center of that case. Prosecutors have denied that claim. Lynn's lawyer, Thomas Bergstrom, may appeal this latest ruling. Lynn was released from prison in August after the Pennsylvania Supreme Court vacated his conviction. The high court affirmed that jurors were prejudiced by hearing hours of testimony about sex abuse unrelated to Lynn's actions as supervisor for the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. Lynn had served nearly 3 years of his 3 to 6 year sentence and already was scheduled for parole when he was released. In 2012, a jury convicted Lynn of one count of endangering the welfare of children. Prosecutors argued that Lynn recommended transferring a known pedophile priest to a parish in northeast Philadelphia. That priest later pleaded guilty to molesting an altar boy there and was defrocked. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
It's been all hands on deck as Philadelphia wrestles with a worsening drug crisis, one that's caused upwards of 900 overdose deaths just last year. The escalating situation has brought together a citywide task force. It's led to the expanded use of the overdose reversing drug Narcan, and now the latest weapon on the front lines is paint and paintbrushes. WHYY's Alana Gordon reports that Mural Arts is opening a new space in the heart of the epidemic with the help of city agencies, community groups, and a deli.
Martin Deli sits right under the L on Kensington Avenue in Somerset.
Hi, my name is Kim Cho. We own the Martin Deli here for 25 years.
Cho's family also owns the space right next door. Cho loves Kensington, but sees it getting a bad rap. He's witnessed firsthand some troubling stuff. Overdoses. Literally, right outside the door.
I mean, OD, I experience every day, you know? Every day from the street, I at least see 2-3 people a week.
Right out here?
Outside.
Cho thinks the area needs more resources and positive outlets for people. He teaches martial arts to kids at a church across the street. And because at one point he studied illustration at the University of the Arts, he also sees art as something that could really revitalize the community.
And I really believe that art really changed people.
So he didn't want to fill the vacant space he owns next door with another pizza shop or cell phone store. He connected with some community development groups over the summer, and then Mural Arts. Laura Byron says it was pretty serendipitous.
We don't want to necessarily come in with all the answers.
Byron heads a Mural Arts program that's been working with the city's Department of Behavioral Health for more than a decade. The partnership first started by bringing art programming and mural making to a methadone clinic, and has since gone into a lot of other places throughout the city. They've helped create over 30 community murals.
One of the main ways in which that functions is it reduces isolation.
Byron says art workshops give people a trusted space to process and express what they're going through, and even connect with a counselor if they want. She's recently witnessed this positive response with people at another active spot in South Philadelphia.
And then when they are in crisis, they're coming there and asking for help.
Byron has some evidence to back this approach, too. Researchers from Yale did some evaluations of the model here and found people often felt safer in their neighborhoods as a result, and that the stigma around mental health went down. Now, Mural Arts is setting up shop in that spot next to Cho's Deli with the help of some public and private funding. The goal is to have a space where residents can connect and come up with creative solutions together, plus murals.
It opens the doors to the wider community without saying this is only for people who are in need of behavioral health services or this is only for adults or children. It's a place that's really for the whole community, for holistic healing, to have conversations that they're not having elsewhere and to gain access to services and programs that they're not necessarily accessing elsewhere.
This Kensington hub opens this weekend. It'll have everything from overdose prevention trainings to art workshops. One of those facilitators will be Alvin Tull of North Philadelphia. He's helped design several murals around the city, and he's also had his own struggles with addiction.
It took 5 years just to be able to think, function, and feel like a human being again after all the devastation.
He says working on mural projects helped him deal and gave him a sense of purpose. It continues to. He says that's critical, as he's still kind of fresh in his recovery.
I'm honored to be here because I know within inside myself I feel the healing already just by being a part of something of this magnitude.
Now he hopes to help others find that sense of purpose inside the space and beyond. I'm Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
Yesterday marked the 7th anniversary of the enactment of the Affordable Care Act. In the context of efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare, let's take the public pulse on healthcare with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Well, Frank, it's very much in the news. Is it also top of mind for the public?
Indeed it is. We gave Americans just a couple of weeks ago a long list of issues, and the availability and affordability of healthcare was at the top of the list. Americans are more worried about that than they are any other problem, and that includes unemployment and the economy, which used to be high. They're down now, but healthcare is very high.
What's the nature of the worry?
Well, it is confusing because Americans, for the most part, have health care and they are satisfied with their health care. It's more a generalized concern that this, based on our data, is something that's extremely important to all of us in our day-in, day-out life.
Well, given that so many Americans now have health care, is the concern that that existing care would be compromised or eliminated?
Yes, I think that's right. Again, this had in the wording of the question affordability. So it may not just be that Americans are worried about no longer having health care at all, although that's a concern at the back of a lot of our minds. It is that it's not going to be affordable anymore. Is all this extraordinarily complex apparatus that we put together to manage our health care in this country changes once more.
Frank, let's turn next to Gallup's World Happiness Report. And I'm wondering, in a preliminary sense, if many of the countries where self-reporting of happiness correlates with those citizens having health care.
I think it does. And this is a fascinating report. This is based on a question that Gallup asked in over 150 countries worldwide and has just been reported as the World Happiness Report. The question is, on a 0 to 10 scale, is this the best possible world you can imagine for yourself or the worst possible world you can imagine for yourself? And the countries that are at the top do tend to be in Scandinavia and be other countries, which I think investigation would show have some kind of more government-run healthcare system than we do in this country. To get to the top of the list, it is Norway. It's a 7.5 on that 0 to 10 scale. And the other countries that come right behind Norway are Denmark, Iceland, Switzerland, Finland, the Netherlands. There's a theme there, Scandinavia. Then Canada, which, as we all know, has a government-run healthcare system. Then New Zealand, Australia, and Sweden. That makes the top 10.
United States?
14th. So we're certainly not in the top 10. On that scale that I mentioned a moment ago, it is 6.9.
Is there much volatility in that scale over time?
Not a lot. Countries will move up and down a little, but these Scandinavian countries, one or the other, have typically been at the top of the list each year that we've measured this indicator of how well off you are in terms of life evaluation.
Is there similar predictability at the bottom of the list?
African countries tend to constitute the majority of those at the bottom. The absolute bottom is the Central African Republic with a score of 2.7. So that's a huge difference. In the people in the Central African Republic and the people in Norway, which constitute the extremes of every question of every country where we ask the question.
Frank, what do you say we come back home and take up President Donald Trump's approval rating this week?
This week, it's hovered around 39%. So he's up a couple of points, but clearly below that 40% mark. And that 39% is unprecedented for a president who has been in office only 2 months. We look back all the way to Dwight Eisenhower, and all presidents had above 50% at this point, some much higher than that. So there's no question that in a context of history, Donald Trump's ratings now slightly below the 40% approval rating are unprecedented 60 days into one's administration.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. The strange special election for a state House seat representing North Philadelphia is staggering toward a messy conclusion. Numbers tallied today show a big Democratic win, and the district attorney's office is launching an investigation into alleged voting irregularities. WHYY's Dave Davies explains.
The balloting Tuesday was bound to be contentious. A legal fight left only a Republican on the ballot in the heavily Democratic district. So Democrats backing their candidate, Emilio Vasquez, and the Green Party pushing Sherry Honkala had to scramble for write-in votes. Turned out most of the votes were write-ins, and city election official Joe Lynch announced the results this morning.
Sherry Honkala received 280 write-in votes. Emilio Vasquez received 1,964 write-in votes. That's it.
He mispronounced both names, but the message was clear. A big win for Democrats. Not so fast, says Honkala. There was foul play in this election.
We have people saying that they were intimidated and were forced to vote for Emilio seniors. We have people that witnessed the tables inside the voting booths passing out Emilio stamps.
A Green Party lawyer says he'll go to federal court to get the results tossed and the election rescheduled. Much of the alleged misconduct occurred on the turf of Democratic ward leader Carlos Matos, who says it's a bunch of hooey.
People just, when they don't see things going their way, they just want to create problems. And if they say that you're a bad guy, they continue to say that, and then people want to believe it. And that's all it is. It's just people talking things because they're not getting what they want. And so they come up with all kinds of accusations.
Those who call Matos a bad guy note that his resume includes a conviction and jail time for bribing an Atlantic City councilman. Democratic lawyer Adam Bonin says you can't just claim fraud, you have to prove it. And he says suing after losing is part of the Green Party playbook. He recalled their lawsuit to get recounts after the presidential election.
Raising allegations of fraud or hacking or abuse of some kind of miscount, it's a great way to raise money. But when you don't have facts to back it up, it doesn't go anywhere in the courts.
It can be hard to get evidence for civil suits, but the Philadelphia DA's office has announced its election fraud task force saw enough funny business on Tuesday to launch an investigation into the election. They're urging anyone with evidence to contact them. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Rick Steves, prolific author, public television mainstay, and host of Travel with Rick Steves, Sunday mornings at 5 on WHYY-FM, will venture to Philadelphia this weekend. He joins us from his home in Washington State. Rick, thanks for being here on Newsworks Tonight.
Nice to be with you, Dave.
First class or coach?
Coach.
Oh, dear. Do you get
I've never spent any money for extra than coach because I would much rather have that money in my destination to have a good dinner or hire a private guide or go to a play or something like that.
Sunday will be busy for you, speaking first in the morning at the Philadelphia Travel Show and then out to the Keswick Theater in Glenside Sunday evening. The topic, broadening your global perspective through travel. And I'd like to focus on the latter and tie it into your 2009 book entitled Travel as a Political Act. And Rick, have politics changed so much that travel in turn has changed in those intervening 8 years?
You know, not really. My focus is Europe. For me, Europe is the wading pool for world exploration. And I love to teach people how to travel in Europe smartly on a budget. And with the politics right now, the same sort of discussions in the United States and frustrations and divisions, they're also cropping up around Europe. So everybody's wondering, what's going on here? They got Brexit and, you know, there's different Trump-like movements around Europe. And it's just fun to get out there and talk to other people and realize we're all dealing with the same challenges and we can compare notes.
For those in America with the time and disposable income to foresee travel in Europe or elsewhere, there's always the mainstream tourism industry eager to separate one from one's wallet. And essentially, they're not going to be favoring the kind of travel you advocate in Travel as a Political Act.
I think there's powerful forces in our society that would find it more convenient and, frankly, more profitable if we're all just dumbed down. Just go to the beach, you know, frequent flyer miles, duty-free shopping, what's the power of your sunscreen? You know, all that's fine, but if it bullies you out of a meaningful experience in your travels, I think you've lost a great opportunity. I've really vowed in my work as a travel teacher to challenge and hopefully inspire people to be engaged and smartened up and learn from history and learn from talking to people who find different truths to be self-evident and God-given.
The first two of 10 tips that you offer in this regard are Get out of your comfort zone and connect with people. Well, that's something you might otherwise hear from a life coach or therapist. Easy to proffer, but how do you act on that? Or how do you advise travelers to act on it?
That's a good point, and that's what distinguishes a good trip for me, is how many people are we actually sitting down with and eating with and sharing ideas with. And when you travel, you can travel in a way where you're gathered together with 400 American tourists. That's 8 tour buses. They're all parked out back, and you can sit there on a stage and watch tired cultural cliches being performed for you. Or you can break away from that mass tourism and just go to a pub. And when you go to a pub, you can know enough about the local traditions where you know that if I sit at a table, people will leave me alone. But if I sit at the bar, people know that I want to talk.
All a part of what I make of as getting in touch with your inner reptile. You call it becoming a cultural chameleon, though by subsuming or trying to subsume our own background, is the point to not let on that we are Americans visiting these other lands?
Oh, not at all. I mean, I think it's great to be an American. I never hide the fact that I'm an American. It makes no sense to me, for all the Americans that are wearing Canadian flags these days. That cultural chameleon thing, Dave, is, I think, really important. You know, for me, for instance, a cup of tea makes no sense at all. I can't remember when I had a cup of tea in the United States. But when I'm in England, a spot of tea feels really nice after a busy day of sightseeing. It's so appropriate in England. When I'm in Greece, I actually feel like a nice ouzo as the sun's going down. I've never once come home in Seattle and felt like having a glass of ouzo, but it's just right when you're in Greece. So if you get yourself into that mindset, you celebrate going local.
Rick, lastly, the enlightened traveler, hopefully the enlightened traveler, comes back to the States and goes back to his or her likely gerrymandered district and then consumes media that supports his or her preconceived notions. How do you break out of those walls?
Boy, that's a good challenge, Dave. And it's sort of, to me, an enlightened electorate that steps into the privacy of the voting booth and doesn't vote for their selfish material best interest, but votes for what's best for both society and what's best for south of the border also. I just think in so many cases when we step into the voting booth, who wins or loses is going to impact struggling people a lot more than it's going to impact us. For me, I'm so thankful that I'm able to travel in a way that is transformational. And if I travel thoughtfully, I'm able to bring home what I consider the most beautiful souvenir, and that is a broader perspective. And then when I implement that broader perspective here as a citizen of this great nation of ours, I'm making travel a political act. And that's what I'll be talking about Sunday night at the Keswick Theater.
Rick Steves, thanks for joining us, and hope you have a wonderful time in our city of brotherly love.
I am looking forward to my time in Philadelphia and hope to see a lot of travelers at my talks. I'll be at the travel show during the middle of the day, and then I'll be at the Keswick Theater that evening.
Rick Steves, prolific author, public television mainstay, and host of Travel with Rick Steves, Sunday mornings at 5 on WHYY-FM. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. A longtime trailblazer of Philadelphia theater has written her first play. Blanka Zitzka had co-founded the Wilma Theater more than 30 years ago and directed over 70 plays, all the while contributing to the revitalization of South Broad Street. Oh, by the way, winning 39 Barrymore Awards as well. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on her debut as an author.
Although she spent her entire adult life in theater, championing the avant-garde and pushing theater production to new levels of creativity, Blanka Zitzka has never written a script, or even wanted to, until she hired playwright Paula Vogel to run a playwriting workshop for war veterans.
We were holding workshops for writers, and I was in the room, and so she made me write.
Blanka is not a veteran, but she is an immigrant. You can hear her accent. She's Czechoslovakian. She defected to the United States in 1973 when she was 18 years old.
I thought I could not write because of my English. I never went to school here, so I always had this handicap of not being a native speaker.
Zitzka overcame that handicap by writing a play about what she knows, being an immigrant from Czechoslovakia. It's called Adapt. It's a dreamy, surreal world of a young woman moving from Prague to New York in the 1970s, both excited about the vibrancy of the West and anxious about losing her old life and her identity.
The point of the play was explore this moment when you are going through profound change, this moment of dislocation. And in that moment of dislocation, you can be really, you are losing your identity. because what you knew you have lost, you left it behind. And what is coming next, you don't know what that is. So this is kind of the moment of total vulnerability, when the dreams and the reality can have the same meaning, floating into each other.
Zitzko wrote this play with her company of actors for a year and a half, so the language and the movement would be natural to those performers and their bodies, not just on the page. And during that time, America's attitude toward immigration has changed a lot. Zitzko says she made changes to this production based on the new administration.
After Trump's election and his decision to build the wall, I decided that the set will be the wall, because also the play is dealing with the Berlin Wall, and we were so happy about tearing the wall down in 1989, right? And now we are talking about building a wall.
ADAPT is now in previews. It opens next week. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
The curtain comes down on tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. At the controls this week, Al Banks, Diana Martinez, and Adam Stanishevsky. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Mussoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations, and our News Director is Eugene Son. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.